It's Your Health, the week's top stories from the health desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. In this program, we'll have two reports on vaccines, one looking at vaccines in the elderly, could they be more effective, and vaccines in children, are they worth it, and do children need so many? But first, we'll hear about some major changes in the DSM. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which describes all the different mental disorders recognized by modern psychiatry. This past week, the American Psychiatric Association released the list of mental disorders that it intends to publish in its new manual. Elise Spiegel reports that one of the biggest changes could affect the ever-growing population of children diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Bipolar disorder in adults is a disease characterized by intense highs and lows. There are periods of mania, there are periods of depression, and it's seen as very serious, a lifelong biological dysfunction. Now, today there are close to 1 million kids diagnosed with bipolar, but that's new. Almost no kids were given the label before the mid-90s. So what happened? According to David Schaffer, one of the people behind the new DSM, there has been a massive, massive case of misdiagnosis.
I don't think anybody is arguing that these are perfectly normal children that get the label. We're saying these kids are very sick, but they probably don't have bipolar disorder, and they probably do deserve a name which adequately describes what they're doing.
And so, Schaffer and his colleagues today proposed in the new DSM a diagnosis called temper dysregulation disorder. A diagnosis they hope will be used by clinicians instead of the bipolar label.
In a sense, we're offering a home for the children that we've been describing, which I think might be seen as more useful and more applicable.
So how is it that a million kids were given the bipolar label in the first place? The rise of childhood bipolar disorder got its start in the early 90s through a 34-year-old researcher named Janet Wozniak. Wozniak was researching kids with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, who had this incredible explosive anger.
These children were continuing, as they got older, past the preschool years, to have outbursts that were occurring on a regular basis, were huge scenes, swearing, kicking, hitting, biting, spitting.
Now, kids with ADHD have trouble controlling their impulses, so anger isn't unusual. But to Wozniak, this felt different. Then one day, she says she had this breakthrough. The problem with the kids was an impulse control. The problem was they couldn't control their mood. The kids were bipolar.
This child who I was thinking of as having really difficult to treat ADHD, I really was ignoring the serious mood component.
Wozniak wrote up a paper which proposed that many of the kids diagnosed with ADHD were actually bipolar, and it was hugely influential. But David Schaffer and many other psychiatrists were never convinced. He says that in order to claim that these kids were bipolar, Wozniak had to change one critical component of the traditional definition of bipolar disorder, also known as manic depression.
The defining feature of manic depression was that it was episodic, that you had episodes of depression and episodes of mania and episodes of normal mood.
But the kids Wozniak described rarely had discrete week-long or month-long episodes. They just had consistent problems with rage. The fact that the kids don't have episodes, Schaffer says, is one reason the people at the DSM were skeptical of the childhood bipolar label. And he also points out that bipolar disorder is supposed to be a lifelong condition, but the kids Wozniak identified don't always grow up to have problems with their moods.
There's not any very good evidence that they grow up to be bipolar, or that if you look at the background of established bipolar adults, that they were like this when they were children.
Schaffer says he and his colleagues were also concerned because of the bipolar drugs given to kids, particularly antipsychotic medications.
Which we think have quite profound effects on important mechanisms in the brain.
It's impossible to say what will happen, whether clinicians will actually alter their practice. But critics of bipolar say this change is long overdue. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Thank you.
Another big change to the DSM this week involves autism. Since 1994, the American Psychiatric Association has recognized a difference between people with autism and people with Asperger's disorder. But that's about to change. In a draft of the DSM, Asperger's is no longer separate from autism. Instead, it's part of a broad category called autism spectrum disorder. NPR's John Hamilton reports on why the group is making the change and how it's being received.
The differences between Asperger's and autism have always been subtle. Both involve restricted, repetitive behaviors and difficulties with social interaction. Asperger's is often considered a mild form of autism, but some people diagnosed with Asperger's actually have more difficulty functioning in society than some people labeled autistic. And who gets which label can be pretty arbitrary. So for health professionals, a single broad category makes sense. But for a lot of people with Asperger's, the proposed change is upsetting.
I personally am probably going to have a very hard time calling myself autistic.
Michael John Carley runs the Global and Regional Asperger Syndrome Partnership in New York. He says many people with Asperger's take pride in a diagnosis associated with some big names.
Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Thomas Jefferson, Emily Dickinson.
Carley says under the new system, these geniuses would represent just one extreme on a spectrum.
And yet on the vast other extreme, somebody who might have to wear adult diapers and maybe a head restraining device. This is very hard for us to swallow, that these two extremes might indeed just have different variations of the same condition.
But Carley says he realizes that there's strong scientific evidence supporting that idea. And he says efforts to separate Asperger's and autism just haven't worked.
The problem is that the clinical world has for so long attempted to draw a line in the sand where autism becomes Asperger's and vice versa. And every time they've tried to draw that line, it's been proven false in practice.
Right now, the diagnosis often hinges on language and communication skills in early childhood. But those are pretty subjective and can change dramatically as a child grows up. Catherine Lord from the University of Michigan is part of the group that decided to combine all the autism-related diagnoses into one. She says the current system is a mess.
The categories are just not used by clinicians in a reliable fashion.
Lord says the change is not an effort to influence how people with Asperger's or autism identify themselves.
The intent is to try to make the diagnosis of autism, what we're calling autism spectrum disorders, clearer and to better reflect the science and also the knowledge of how people use these terms.
So instead of agonizing over autism versus Asperger's, clinicians can focus on each person's specific difficulties with communication or social interaction or information processing. To experts in the field, that sounds like a good idea. Roy Richard Grinker is an anthropologist at George Washington University. He's studied autism in other cultures and in his own family.
As somebody who has a child with a diagnosis of autism, I want to be able to turn to the official criteria and see a description that sounds like my child. Right now, my child sounds like three or four different disorders.
Grinker says when his daughter was three, she met the criteria for classic autism. Now that she's 18, she would probably be considered Asperger's, or maybe just a quirky kid. At the moment, different diagnostic labels may qualify people for different services. But Grinker says losing the Asperger's diagnosis does not mean families will lose services they need.
Almost anybody with an Asperger's diagnosis also could qualify for what is called autistic disorder.
And he says the change could actually make it easier for parents who are struggling to get help for a child with Asperger's.
They may be denied services from certain regional or state centers because their child doesn't have a diagnosis of autism. I know this is the case in California. And so removing Asperger's really removes what is a false barrier to parents getting care for their kids.
The American Psychiatric Association plans to spend the next few months reviewing comments on the proposed changes. The new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is due out in 2013. John Hamilton, NPR News.
So, shots. If you're a child in this country, you've probably had a lot of them. 24 vaccines, to be exact, before the age of two. We'll look at why that shot schedule was developed. But first, vaccines are not just for kids. A new report finds about one-third of adults over 65 who should be immunized against pneumonia are not. NPR's Patty Naiman takes a look at how vaccines work and how they can be made more effective in older people.
It's not just getting older adults immunized that's a challenge. When they do get their shots, they're not as fully protected as younger people. To see why, it's helpful to understand just how the immune system of a younger adult responds to a vaccine. What they're getting is a shot made up of little pieces of the germ, the invader, that causes the disease.
And pieces of bacteria are foreign and pieces of viruses are foreign.
So then, says Dr. Stefan Gravenstein of Brown University, your immune system goes into action when it gets a vaccine.
The body then sends cells to that site, recognizing that this is something foreign.
But is it friend or foe? Gravenstein says these immune system cells know just how to figure that out, and then they start to fight back. The first thing they need? More troops.
They develop a way to make copies of themselves that can also recognize that same foreign thing. And they make lots of copies and then get spread throughout the body. So now you have a refined surveillance system for the whole body.
Like microscopic spies searching the bloodstream for enemies, some of these spying cells also begin to make antibodies, which are like little flags that literally attach themselves to the foreign invader, alerting the rest of the immune system to their exact location. And that's when the killer cells go into action. Some of them work like this.
When they get close to that virus, they have things called perforins that perforate the surface of the virus, the membrane, that then allow it to leak out its contents.
Punching holes in the invading organism and bursting it apart. Other killer cells absorb the remains of the foreign invader and use their enzymes to chew it up. So a vaccine trains the immune system to build up a defense and be ready for battle against a real virus or bacteria. But somewhere between your 50s and 70s, your whole immune reaction, you could say, just sort of loses its pep. When confronted with a vaccine or a real germ, the immune system of an older person makes less of everything. Fewer spy cells, fewer antibodies, and fewer killer cells.
Now, it doesn't need to be that depressing because we can change the environment and these cells work much better.
Using workarounds that can sort of trick the older immune system into behaving like a young one. Gravenstein says scientists are investigating chemicals that can be added to vaccines to stimulate the immune system to produce more antibodies and more killer cells. And vaccines can be given in bigger doses. Infectious disease specialist Anne Falsey of the University of Rochester in New York headed a study of 4,000 people over 65. One-third got a standard flu vaccine. Two-thirds received a vaccine that was four times the usual dose.
The group who received the high-dose vaccine had a significantly better antibody response, about twice as good as the group who got the usual vaccine.
With minimal side effects.
A little bit more in the way of a sore arm, a little more redness, and a little more swelling. But generally, it was quite well tolerated.
The FDA recently approved a new high-dose flu vaccine for older Americans. And there's one final strategy to better protect older Americans, according to Dr. Ken Schmader, chief of geriatrics at Duke University Medical Center.
When children are immunized against things like influenza and pneumococcal disease, it appears to help protect older adults as well. As children have gotten the new pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, for instance, and that's been since the year 2000, serious pneumococcal infections have declined in older adults.
And Schmader says healthcare workers who are around older adults should also be vaccinated. That's a group who have resisted mandatory vaccinations in the past. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
This is Joanne Silberner. When it comes to her new baby, 37-year-old Elise Vandermeer of Atlanta feels like most parents.
She's the love of my life, and I would do absolutely anything, anything to protect her.
Look, Lena. And when Lena Rose was born 7 months ago, Elise had a decision to make about her healthy baby. Should she immunize her?
I'm a little intimidated by the schedule. There are 24 shots scheduled in a two-year period, and that is not including the flu shot. So it is a concern.
A survey 10 years ago showed that a quarter of parents were concerned that vaccines might be too much for a baby's immune system. But when you look at the biology, it seems less daunting. Even fetuses have immune system cells, as early as 14 weeks gestation. Edgar Marcuse, professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, says one part of the immune system takes a little longer to kick in, but babies are born pretty much ready to go.
The infant immune system can respond to most everything. As soon as they're born, they are bombarded with all the things that exist in our world.
He and some colleagues once calculated giving 11 vaccines all at one time, which no one does, would use up only 0.1% of the capacity of a baby's immune system, and even that would quickly regenerate. Still, Elise Vandermeer wondered if she should at least space out the vaccines. So she talked to Lena Rose's pediatrician.
My doctor was actually very open. He said, you know, she's your baby. We'll do whatever you want. We'll be flexible. But he did advise me against it for two reasons.
First, the number of office visits needed to give the shots one at a time. Edgar Marcuse explains reason two.
When you space out the vaccines, you leave your infant susceptible to diseases you could otherwise have prevented, particularly when they're most at risk in the first 6 or 8 months of life.
Babies can get whooping cough, they can get meningitis, and these diseases can be very serious. But what about all those foreign substances going into babies' bodies, the viruses and bacteria, or, more precisely, the parts of them that are used to make vaccines? Well, vaccines now are cleaner than they used to be, says Saad Omer of Emory University. He studies parents' concerns about immunizations.
A lot of people say that the number of vaccines has gone up. Actually, the number of antigens, which is the active part of a vaccine, hasn't gone up. It has gone down in the U.S. population.
An antigen is a part of a virus or bacterium used in a vaccine. The 5 injections given to kids back in 1980 contained a total of about 3,000 different antigens. 20 years later, there were 15 more injections, and the total number of antigens was down to about 125, from 3,000 to 125. Another thing missing from childhood vaccines that some parents worried could hurt their babies is a preservative called thimerosal that contains mercury. Omer says one thing a lot of parents today don't realize, getting exposed to childhood infections is far worse than getting the vaccines. Take measles. Here's what that disease did to kids before there was a vaccine.
So what the study shows that 1 in 1,000 kids who got measles, so measles infection, had brain damage or an illness related to that. And 1 in 500 kids had a risk of dying in this country. This is not data from, let's say, Nigeria or Bangladesh.
The risk from getting the measles vaccine is a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of some brain damage. And deaths, the risk is too low to even calculate. Both Omer and Marcuse say understanding the risks and benefits of vaccines is a lot of information for new parents. Elise Vandermeer talked with friends, with her doctors. She read up as much as she could, and she's going ahead with Lena Rose's vaccines on schedule. But Elise admits even though she knows it's the best thing to do, she says a few Hail Marys each time. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Join me again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis, and thanks for listening.